1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This Thursday morning at 7 o'clock, you can help make WILL Pledge Drive history. Hi, I'm Station Manager Jay Pierce. We'll be attempting to complete a full day's fundraising in 1 hour. That's right, just a single hour of fundraising the entire day, Thursday, October 19th. So please, help make pledge drives on WILL Radio shorter and more efficient by calling in your gift on Thursday morning at 7. And thanks.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Last week, the government of North Korea announced that it had carried out an underground test of a nuclear weapon. The government there in Pyongyang called it a great leap forward and said that the test would contribute to defending the peace of the Korean Peninsula. However, around the world, governments condemned the test, saying that it was in fact a threat to the security and stability of the region. This morning in this part of the show, we'll talk about this continuing crisis over North Korea and its ambition to build nuclear weapons. And our guest for the program is Thomas Hubbard. He is the former ambassador of the United States to South Korea. He served from 2001 until 2004 as the ambassador to the Republic of Korea. That was part of his long career, 39 career in the Foreign Service. He has had a number of posts. Before becoming ambassador, he was the principal deputy assistant secretary of state for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. He also served in the Philippines and the Dominican Republic and in Japan in various capacities during his time in the Foreign Service. He also was a principal negotiator of the 1994 agreed framework that was aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear weapons program. He became the first senior official to lead a U.S. government delegation to North Korea in 94 when he was dispatched by President Clinton to secure the release of a U.S. pilot who was captured after his helicopter was shot down over North Korea. Now he continues to make his home in Washington and is a senior advisor to a law firm that works with clients that are interested in have concerns in Korea, other countries in Asia. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, and we're very pleased that he could be here on the program with us and to talk about this subject. Questions, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. All we ask callers is that people are brief as they possibly can be so we can keep things moving along, get in as many different people as we possibly can. But certainly, the idea here is that listeners can ask questions, and we encourage that. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are interested in calling in, being involved in the conversation, can certainly do that. Well, I thank you very much for being with us and talking about the subject.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's good to be here.
Can you talk a little bit first? Let's talk about the timing of the North Korean test. One of the questions that certainly has been raised, a lot of people have raised, is why now? Why is it at this point that the government of North Korea decided to go ahead and do what it did?
Well, I think it reflects some frustration on the part of the North Korean leader that the world doesn't seem to be taking him seriously enough. I think it is, in a way, a cry for attention. I think the test is a culmination of a long effort by North Korea to produce nuclear weapons. I think their nuclear programs began back in the 70s. I think by the early 90s, we realized they were seeking nuclear weapons. So the test is kind of a culmination of that, and it's his effort to say, hey, you got to take me seriously. I've got this weapon.
I think that there are a number of ways of looking at the question, why is it that North Korea would want nuclear weapons at all? Mm-hmm. The North Koreans, it seems that they have a genuine fear that they are threatened by the United States. So And there, I suppose there's a possibility that they have concerns about other countries in their
sure.
region.
Mm-hmm.
So one might say that on one level you'd say, well, that it's part of their defensive structure. They feel that it's something they need to defend themselves against the threat. There is also the other way of looking at it and saying, well, what this is it's a kind of a bargaining chip. I mean, it is, as you say, it's mm-hmm. something that the government of North Korea can use to get the attention of the rest of the world, and perhaps also in the effort to get something, it is something that they can then give up. Mm-hmm. So and so then you can look at the weapons in two sorts of ways. One as an something that actually functions as part of their defense, mm-hmm. and the other in which it's kind of a political matter, really, and it's more of a matter of this business of trying to get what they want, whether that's acknowledgement from the rest of the world or some kind of material assistance or maybe both. Mm-hmm. How do you weigh those two things, particularly the concerns, the stated concerns that they have, that they feel threatened, particularly by the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. That I think the North Korean leader does fear the United States. He has seen what we did in Iraq. He's heard what we've said about Iran. He's read the various documents in which we talk about preemptive action. So I think he genuinely does fear the United States, and he's been very clear in saying that his nuclear weapons are meant as a deterrence to secure North Korea from the United States. I think at the same time, the nuclear programs are also probably a bargaining chip. In other words, that in the first order, they're for protection. In the second order is a way of extracting the kinds of security assurances from the United States and perhaps the rest of the world that he feels he needs to feel secure. So I believe it is possible with the right combination of pressure and diplomacy, of carrots and sticks, to create circumstances in which the North Korean leader would feel he could safely give up this deterrent. Mm-hmm. But we're certainly not there yet.
The administration has now, particularly recently, but not only recently, been questioned about the possibility of having one-on-one talks between the government of the United States and the government of North Korea, and that the administration has continued to support the idea of the six-party talks as being the way to go. And in fact, Mr. Bush just very recently and other people speaking for the administration said, you know, people are always criticizing us for being unilateral. So in this case, we're trying not to be unilateral. We're committed to this multi-party talk sort of thing, and that we're not going to. They seem very adamant about the idea of not sitting down one-on-one with North Korea. And I think that there are other people who say, well, that might not be such a bad idea. So maybe you don't send the Secretary of State. Send Jim Baker. Send Jimmy Carter. You know, there are a lot of people that you could send to do this that would be semi official, but that might be a good thing. And what do you think first of all, just about the idea of, you know, a one-on-one U.S. and North Korea sitting down and talking?
Well, I think we should be more active in dealing directly with the North Koreans one-on-one in addition to the multilateral talks. The Clinton administration did conduct bilateral talks with North Korea up to a visit by Secretary of State Albright to North Korea. I was with her on that trip, and I think it brought some fruits. The agreed framework was our means of trying to put an end to the North Korean nuclear programs under the Clinton administration was not perfect, but it brought a lot of benefits. It did freeze their plutonium-based program, which is the one they just used to collect the material they used in this test. So I think there were some definite benefits and some merits in our dealing bilaterally with them. I also think that the multilateral talks are the right way to go, the best way to go. It's the best way to engage our friends and partners and allies. China has potential influence. We have a lot of interests in common with South Korea and Japan. Russia, we all have various kinds of influence to bring to bear and various interests to work through. So multilateral talks are a good thing. They should be part of our diplomatic toolkit. But I think at some point in the Bush administration that the six-party talks sort of ceased to be an instrument of policy and became a fixation. And to a certain degree, this stress on multilateralism became an excuse not to talk to the North Koreans, which a lot of our leaders didn't want to do for reasons relating more to their character, as President Bush said. It's part of an axis of evil, and there's been a great reluctance to talk to this leader who treats his people so badly and is so threatening to the world. You mentioned Jim Baker. I happen to agree very strongly with what he said the other day on, I think it was on Meet the Press, that he doesn't consider talking to the enemy to be appeasement. I think he's absolutely right. I think the six-party talks are the right way to go, but they won't work unless the U.S. is willing to be more active bilaterally, more active in dealing directly with the North Koreans. The trick here, if we're ever to forestall this nuclear program in North Korea, is to convince the North Koreans that they have more to gain by giving up the weaponry, more to gain by joining the international community and behaving responsibly than they do by continuing to wield these weapons. To my mind, that means that to do that, the United States needs to be more active directly to give the North Korean leader some of the face and prestige he wants through bilateral talks, but also to be more upfront and making clear to the North Koreans what they have to gain from responsible behavior. I think at the same time, the Chinese and the South Koreans need to be more clear in telling the North Koreans what they have to lose by not giving up the weapons. And that's why I think the sanctions that were approved by the UN at the end of last week and that are now being implemented are a good way of showing the North Koreans what they have to lose.
Yeah. So, well, here, you've given me a number of opportunities for asking further mm-hmm. questions, but let me ask this one just to start. I think that there are some people who argue that the very purpose of the six-party talks was to try to persuade the North Koreans not to do what they have now already mm-hmm. done. So then, but you would not agree with somebody who would say, well, now what's the point of continuing the six-party talks because essentially we might say that they failed if the North Koreans went ahead and developed the bomb and they did the test. Well, so what's the point of keep continuing on that track? Sounds like you would not say that.
No, I would not. I think we should continue. I think what we should be aiming at now is to bring the North Koreans back into the six-party talk. Mm-hmm. A year ago, September 19th, we agreed to a declaration in the six-party talks in which the North Koreans indicated a willingness to give up their nuclear weapons programs. The North Koreans have reiterated that they're prepared to do that. But a first requirement is some form of direct dialogue with the United States. I believe we should be willing to make that extra effort to try to bring about the implementation of that declaration.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Thomas Hubbard. He is the former ambassador to the Republic of Korea. He served from 2001 until 2004. He also had a number of other postings in the Foreign Service, had a long career in the Foreign Service. He also was one of the principal negotiators of the 1994 agreed framework that was aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear weapons program. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We're pleased to have him on the program. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The thing that all along here we've been told is that the country that has the biggest leverage, has the most leverage on North Korea is China.
Yes.
I guess I'm wondering whether you think, in fact, now China to date, let's talk about before the test, and then we could talk about after the test. Mm-hmm. So everything leading up to the point that the test occurred, do you think that the Chinese were doing everything that they could?
Well, I think you have to distinguish in the case of the Chinese between influence and leverage. Mm-hmm. The Chinese frequently say they have no influence. In fact, they told the North Koreans not to test their missiles back in July. They did it anyway. They told the North Koreans not to test their nukes more recently, and they did it anyway. I'm sure the Chinese are quite angry. They can't tell the North Koreans what to do. On the other hand, they do have very substantial leverage because they provide, I think, most of North Korea's fuel and a substantial amount of their food supplies, and they're one of North Korea's few friends in the world. So if they were prepared to exercise all of that leverage, they could have great impact. But The Chinese, I believe, are torn. They don't want nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula any more than we do. But they also don't want disruption, chaos, disorder, or even regime change in North Korea because of the concern this would, make North Korea even more of an economic basket case, that there would be huge social problems, including a big flow of refugees. In many cases, the South Koreans are in the same position on this point. So I think they will, and they are, cooperating in the UN sanctions, but I don't believe they're prepared to take sanctions to the point where it would really risk the fall of the North Korean government or some kind of domestic and implosion in North Korea that would create social disorder.
Well, that leads to my question about, okay, now the after the test took place, would you say about the Chinese is certainly true. The Chinese said, don't test the missiles. They did it anyway. They said, don't test the bomb. They did it anyway. So clearly the Chinese are really angry. Mm-hmm. They've said so, and they're probably even angrier than what they have said.
Yes.
At the same time, you wonder, well, in what way does that translate into action? And, for example, we now have this package of sanctions proposed against North Korea, and one of the things that it calls for is inspection of cargo. Mm-hmm. Coming out of North Korea, going into North Korea, the idea is they're going to try to look for anything that would involve the technology, weapons technology.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem really clear whether the Chinese will actually do that. And I guess I have read both, that they would or that they weren't going to.
Yeah.
So it's not really clear to me what the Chinese are going to do. It continues to raise in my mind the question, yes, even though the Chinese are very unhappy with the government of North Korea, what it is they're now willing to do. In terms of putting pressure on them.
They do seem to be inspecting cargo much more thoroughly than they did in the past. I've seen pictures on television overnight of trucks being stopped on the border. I think the Chinese are going to engage in that. I think the sanctions package calls not only for a ban on trade and in high-tech weaponry, but also a ban on trade and in luxury goods. And the North Korean leader is one who enjoys luxury goods and enjoys sharing fine wines and good food with his supporters. So I think the Chinese may be cooperating on that to a certain degree, and that will inflict some pain. But again, I don't think the Chinese are going to join in. What we need now, to my mind, is a combination of pressure and diplomacy. That we are applying that pressure through this UN sanctions. I don't think there'll be a certain amount of cooperation from the Chinese and South Koreans, but we also need diplomacy. That diplomacy should focus not only on the UN, but also on these six-party talks. But we need more active U.S. engagement to make it successful, in my mind.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question that maybe if you wanted to be diplomatic, you wouldn't answer. As I mentioned, you were involved in this effort to achieve this agreement back in 1994 when Bill Clinton was president. And then when George Bush became president, it was during the first 4 years of the Bush administration, you were the ambassador to South Korea. Just how problematic was it that the Bush administration took at least rhetorically, a very belligerent stance toward North Korea? When George Bush said that North Korea was part of the axis of evil and he said some very impolitic things about the leader of North Korea, did that make things worse?
Yes, in my mind, it very clearly did. That in the Clinton administration, we had reached an accord which froze their plutonium program, preventing the production of perhaps as many as 50 nuclear warheads between 1994 and 2002. In that process, we built up habits of dialogue and of communication with the North Koreans that helped us deal with problems when they arose. For example, in 1997, I think it was, we discovered a huge excavation in North Korea. We thought it might be a covert nuclear program. In fact, we were able to get access to that site and demonstrate that it wasn't. So, you know, we gave up habits of communication and went beyond that by saying insulting things about the North Korean leader. To his credit, President Bush said constantly, we have no intention of invading or attacking North Korea. But I think this the belligerent language created the sense of paranoia and threat in North Korea. It also made it very hard to talk to those people. One of the first things my experience tells me, and I've spent probably as much time face-to-face with North Koreans as anybody in the U.S. government, the first thing North Korean negotiators want is face, some respect, some prestige. Clinton was willing to give them that through our direct talks, et cetera, by dispatching Madeleine Albright to North Korea. Face ought to be the cheapest thing for us to give. Face and security assurances ought to be the easiest thing to give. The hard things are the economic bargaining that follows that. But in fact, we've refused that central element that I think the North Koreans need to come back to the dialogue table.
I have a couple of callers here, and I will get to them. I promise I will not make them wait too much longer. Let me just ask you one basic question about the agreed framework of 1994. Here, this was the effort by the Clinton administration to try to persuade the North Koreans not to go ahead and develop nuclear weapons. And we sort of said to North Korea, look, if you will do that, then what we will do is we'll help you, essentially we'll help you try to meet your need for energy. There also seemed to be the idea that, you know, given time, it would be possible to move toward more kind of normal relations.
That's right.
That sort of was the basic
idea. That's correct.
Idea.
That's the concept.
And so then the question is, well, what happened? There are some people who say, well, the problem was that the North Koreans, they never were really going to play. They never gave up their idea, their nuclear ambition. Some people say, well, the fact of the matter is that the United States really didn't fulfill the commitment that we made. We made promises. What people say is, it's either one side or the other made promises that they didn't keep, and that's the reason why we're here now. So what about that? Whose fault was it this didn't work?
Well, I think the fundamental fault was on the North Korean side, that they dragged their feet in meeting some of their commitments under the agreed framework. We were not as complete in fulfilling our commitments as we should have been either, but I think we did better than the North Koreans did. We were in the process of building light water reactors. We did supply the fuel oil that was part of the package. We did try to work ahead on improving relations by lifting sanctions and the like. But the basic fault is on the North Korean side. They cheated. They began, you know, somewhere after signing the agreed framework, maybe around 97, 98, began working on this separate covert uranium enrichment program, which was clearly a violation of the agreed framework. So, but I think we exacerbated. We had a program that was a partial success or a partial failure, depending on whether you want to say the glass is half full or half empty. Mm. It did freeze the most dangerous and imminent part of their nuclear program. I do fault the Bush administration for losing this habit of dialogue, for using the kind of language that it made it harder to continue that dialogue. And most importantly, I think, when we discovered the problem with the enriched uranium program, that we could have found a more diplomatic way to handle it. It seems to me we threw the baby out with the bathwater, that as a result of our calling them on a nuclear program that was many years from successful production of fissile material, we created a situation in which we lost the program that had been freezing the most imminent part and that led directly to this problem. So, you know, let's not make any mistake. North Korea is at fault for this problem. North Korea should not be seeking nuclear weapons. But I think that the Bush administration handled the issue badly and exacerbated the issue.
All right. We have some callers we will get right to as soon as I introduce again our guest, Thomas Hubbard. He served from 2001 until 2004 as the U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Korea. He was 39 years in the Foreign Service. Right before his appointment to Korea, he was Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. And he has had postings other places around the world, Philippines, Japan, Dominican Republic, also held positions in Washington in the State Department. He was a principal negotiator of that 1994 agreed framework that was aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear weapons program. And in fact, he was the first senior official to lead a government delegation to North Korea in 1994 when he was sent there by President Bill Clinton to try to secure the release of a U.S. serviceman, an Army pilot, who was captured after his helicopter was shot down over North Korea. He is here visiting, Ambassador Hubbard, here visiting on the campus, and we're pleased to have him with us. Questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll start in with some folks in Urbana, line number one first. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. First, let me express my very high esteem and respect for Ambassador Hubbard. I agree with almost everything he said and find it to be very, very true. I have only one small quibble, and that is in regard to face-to-face talks. I was involved as an interpreter in the original truce talks in Korea many, many years ago, and from the very beginning, the North Koreans and Chinese would not allow us to tape record the proceedings. And very frequently, when they produced the minutes of the meetings, which they delayed inordinately, the minutes of the meetings as they recorded them were very different from what really happened. And I think one of the great virtues of the Six Power meeting is that there are other witnesses to the commitments that the North Koreans have made, whereas when we go it alone, it's simply our word against theirs. And certainly, considering all of the criticism that Bush has and the lack of credibility that he seems to have now, I am not at all sure that people would believe our word over theirs. And I wonder what the ambassador thinks about that aspect of one-on-one talks.
Well, thank you very much, sir. That is really a very good question. And I'll have to say I have tremendous respect for anyone who speaks Korean and who has spent the amount of time that you must have with the North Koreans during the time of the truce talks. It is a very good point. A merit of multilateral talks is the fact that, you know, there are, in effect, other witnesses there, other countries are there with us. And a particular merit is that the South Koreans are in the room with us as we talk to the North Koreans. When I was doing the agreed framework talks, we often had issues in which we were consulting very closely with the South Koreans, briefing them, spending probably 4 hours with the South Koreans for every 1 hour we spent with the North. But the North did from time to time come out with interpretations in Korean that the South Koreans would read, and it did affect their trust in us. So that is a demerit. I think the six-party talks ought to be the main event, but my argument... But my argument is that we need to make the six-party talks work by being more prepared to deal bilaterally with the North, despite the issues. One interesting point here is that during the time we were doing the agreed framework talks, the South Korean government was somewhat jealous, was not absolutely pleased with the fact that we were doing this, and very much wanted to be in the room. Now we have a different South Korean government, the second one after that, and they very much want us to supplement the multilateral talks with bilateral talks, and I think they're now prepared to live with some of the misunderstandings that arise from that.
All right. Well, let's talk again with someone else. This is line number two next. I want to thank last caller. Here, go on. Line two. Hello.
Good morning, Ambassador Hubbard. I'm really fascinated with your description. I read Madeleine Albright's autobiography, which included the trip you just mentioned to North Korea. And now we're seeing in the United States, most recently, Senator McCain, who wants to be president, criticizing that diplomatic effort and insinuating that, well, directly charging that it enabled North Korea to begin this program to produce nuclear weapons. Do you have a response for that kind of straight-on attack?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, my reading of Senator McCain's statement suggests that there were a lot of inaccuracies in what he put forward. But the fact is, as I said, the agreed framework was less than perfect, but it did freeze North Korea's plutonium program for 8 years. And in the absence of that, they would have produced as many as 50 nuclear weapons. So,
well, if it helps any, just this weekend on the media show, a journalist with experience in South Korea also refuted Senator McCain. So,
well, thank you very much. So, yep. I think the fact is, the agreed framework did not prevent North Korea from launching this separate covert program based on enriched uranium, and we have to call that a partial failure. But I guess my argument is that we should have fixed the defects in the Clinton program while making it better. And what we actually did was throw the whole thing out, and with the result that they're now using what was frozen then to test nuclear weapons now.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Champaign County. This is another caller here, line number 3. Hello.
Hello again. Just last night, Selig Harrison was arguing with someone about this most recent agreement, the round table, and pointed out that 3 days after that was settled, another unit of this government and this Bush administration put down some bank regulation sort of things that they could do without Congress that undermined any of the goodwill that was going on, and it was seen as completely as a betrayal. I cite Bruce Cummings, who says everything we know about, we understand in the commonplace arguments about this is probably inaccurate. And he also pointed out in the New York Times, I think it was the Friday after the July 4th, that, and he rarely gets the press that he should have, because I think he's a trenchant critic, even if you don't agree with him. It's illuminating. But he pointed out that from the point of view of the North Koreans, there were massive military maneuvers that the U.S. was doing with South Korea, and I forget who else, probably some Japanese ships and planes involved as well, immediately in that same week. So the belligerence of testing missiles is highlighted, but the so-called security arrangement and the testing of emergency response or military action is not regarded as belligerent or destabilizing in any way. I have another some other few points, which is '94 when the Congress went to the Republicans. I've heard from a number of people, including Cummings, that that's when the undermining of the framework agreement actually started. They were holding back. You know, the reactors were being built, but they were basically a big hole. I've heard it described. So you didn't mention that part of it. I mean, one says that when the Bush administration came in, but actually the agreed framework was being undermined right from its inception.
Well, I think there are certain. Let me take your second point first. I think there are certain merits to that argument that when we negotiated the 94 agreed framework, that we had, those of us negotiating it, had contemplated lifting U.S. sanctions more quickly than actually happened, and we had also contemplated that the United States would contribute financially to building the light water reactors in North Korea. The advent of the Republican-controlled Congress made both of those things very difficult, and we did not move forward as quickly as we wanted to. I guess I would put more blame on the North Koreans for the delays in building the LWRs and the like than I would on the United States. But there's some merit to your argument. I heard Sig Harrison and Balbina Huang last night on television also, and I think Harrison is right in pointing out the lack of coordination in the U.S. government that had us imposing these new financial measures just after we had reached this important agreement with in the six-party context. The U.S. government needs to do better on that. Obviously, we have to protect our currency and protect our system from money laundering, but seems to me we could have been more coordinated diplomatically than that.
What about this overall idea that, you know, the U.S. can have its war games? I'm no apologist for the Korean administration, in no way, and I just think that we should be more even-handed. If we're if someone was having a major military maneuver and it was a declared enemy, et cetera, in the Caribbean, I think we would be concerned about it, you know, particularly if we weren't a superpower or hyperpower, whatever we are.
Well, I think our maneuvers are defensive, not aggressive, and part of our deterrence and part of our alliance with South Korea. Again, I think we ought to try to do better in coordinating the timing of various events. But you know, our forces—it's very clear—our forces aren't there to attack North Korea. They're there to defend South Korea, deter any attack from North Korea and South Korea.
Well, it's clear to us, I guess we would say, and maybe it's not clear to everybody over here. But one other thing, there was a guy who had written a book about Japan that David interviewed a couple of days ago. And the very end of the very end of the talk, he mentioned that his reading of the South Korean attitude is that most, I would think he would say most South Koreans, particularly younger ones, actually blame the U.S. for in some way, provoking the circumstance, that whether it's ham-handed diplomacy and lack of coordination, or, you know, different factions wanting to do different things in our administration, that the sentiment is not just the pictures of the Korean War veterans that we see in the AP reporting, that there is a lot of conflict along the whole range of the South Korean population, and that the people are not ready to throw away sunshine and eventual reunification, just because the U.S. hasn't, you know, ended the Korean War yet after 60 years. Thanks, I'll listen.
Thanks. I think that is an excellent point, and one that I wanted to bring up, and that is the extent to which what's now going on complicates the relationship between the United States and South Korea.
It is a very difficult issue. I think over time, our threat perception has diverged, and our sense of appropriate tactics or even strategy has diverged. I think both U.S. and South Korea can agree we don't want nuclear weapons in North Korea, and we want to get to that through diplomacy. But I think the South Koreans have a longer-term approach to this problem than we have. They're looking to eventual unification. They are looking to engagement, particularly in the aftermath of Kim Dae-jung's trip to North Korea, as the best means of transforming North Korean society so that peaceful unification can take place. But they recognize this is going to take some time. I think the U.S. is more focused on the nuclear issue, is particularly concerned about the potential for transfer of nuclear materials or nuclear weaponry from North Korea to other terrorist states. We're less patient. We're, I think, less comfortable in seeing the kind of regime that exists in North Korea, the way this regime treats its people, the way it behaves in terms of development of weapons. You know, I do not believe that the Bush administration seeks regime change as the object of our policy in North Korea. But I think most Americans, there would be few tears shed if the North Korean regime should fall. I think the South Koreans are genuinely, like the Chinese, worried about the consequences of a fall of that regime in terms of economic burden, in terms of refugees, societal problems, and they're prepared to look at it in a more long-term way.
Yeah. Well, I think the expectation is, I suppose, if you set no time horizon at all, that someday there will be reunification. And certainly it is something that the South Koreans seem to be interested in. But as you say, they're very concerned about how this happens and the fact that this would be a gradual and not a cataclysmic sort of process.
They're looking for a soft landing.
Yeah, exactly. Are we thinking about? I just wonder, to pick some numbers out of the hat. I mean, are we thinking about, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years within our lifetimes that this is something that we're likely to see?
Well, Kim Dae-jung, not long after his his visit to Pyongyang in the year 2000, said he saw it in a 25-year time frame, first the South Koreans would be working to reduce tensions, to building reconciliation, to help transform North Korean society and North Korean economy, and you know, at the end of 25 years or so, the conditions would be ripe for some kind of unification. I think most South Koreans see it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned? Do you think there is reason for concern that it seems that certainly some places in East Asia, we are seeing both an increase in nationalism and, let us say, an increase in anti-Americanism?
Well, I think all over the world we have seen some increase, sometimes very large increase in anti-Americanism, partially as a result of our invasion of Iraq, partly because of other alleged manifestations of a U.S. unilateralism. In fact, one South Korean I heard talked about, you know, the rise of nationalism in Japan and in the form of some degree of remilitarization, the rise of nationalism in the case of South Korea in terms of a greater sense of national identity, ethnic identity with North Korea, and in the U.S. in the form of this unilateralism that the world talks about. So I think we had wonderful goodwill in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, but with a few exceptions, and Japan may be an exception where our relationship has probably grown even closer since 9/11. There has been a public disaffection from some of our activities.
Let us talk with someone else. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I had read that North Korea was very good at counterfeiting a lot of things, especially $100 bills. And I'm just wondering, in terms of sanctions, it seems we are probably already trying to limit whatever their economy produces. Do you think we can actually do much more to curtail their activities?
Well, you're correct that the North Koreans have made a very good version of the $100 bill. They have engaged in substantial counterfeiting of our currency, and that was really the main backdrop to our imposition of some financial restrictions that we talked about earlier. These sanctions that I think we talked about earlier from the UN are aimed at a variety of things, and certainly there are other things that we could cut off. But I think we have to stop and think, you know, who will be the victims of strict sanctions, and frankly, it'll be the North Korean people rather than the North Korean regime, which seems to be able to tolerate very poor conditions for its people. The question of sanctions. If our objective is to get the North Koreans back to a productive diplomatic approach to this problem, we need to ask ourselves, will further sanctions, which will further isolate North Korea, help us get there or not? I have some doubt that imposing more sanctions on a regime that is already the most isolated in the world will really bring about the change in behavior that we're looking for. The North Koreans do tend to react badly to pressure.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. In this part of the world, already even before the North Koreans conducted their test, we had three states that had demonstrated capability to produce nuclear weapons: Russia, Pakistan, and India. So now we add North Korea. And there are some people who are concerned, and I think among them, Mohammed al-Baradei, who are concerned about proliferation issues,
right,
and the fact that this might lead other countries that are not now nuclear weapon states to also move in that direction. South Korea, perhaps. Japan, perhaps. Of course, China has nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
What do you think? Are there real concerns here for the fact that other nations might move in this direction? And the one where you might think that there would be the greatest sort of concern, and also maybe the place where historically there would be pressures against doing it, would be Japan.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I think you need to think about dominoes, and one potential domino and proliferation domino is Iran, and I think the signal to Iran is one of the reasons that it was very important the UN General Assembly adopt these sanctions last week, to make clear that you can't violate international norms without consequences. Japan, I think, is a special case, as you suggest. Japan is the country that is potentially the number one victim of North Korea. North Koreans have demonstrated a capacity to send missiles to Japan. It's not beyond question that they could somehow fashion a warhead. Japan is, I think, fear over North Korea has led to a greater, much greater military consciousness in Japan. I personally do not believe that Japan will go nuclear under these circumstances. In fact, I don't think Japan will go nuclear unless it loses faith in its alliance with the United States and in the nuclear umbrella that we provide, which the president reaffirmed last week. One of the reasons I think we need to remain very engaged in this issue, rather than kind of turning it all over to the Chinese, is a continued active U.S. presence in the region is very important in maintaining Japanese confidence in our protection, as well as South Korean confidence in our protection. But so long as the Japanese have faith in our ability to provide this nuclear umbrella and help them solve problems that are a serious security concern to them, I think they will remain a non-nuclear power.
Yeah. Well, you talked about the fact that you think that it's important for talks to continue and that it's important for us for the United Nations to continue to try to put some pressure on the North Koreans. So we would hope that the talks would continue in some form. We have these sanctions imposed by the United Nations in response to this first test. The North Koreans have talked about a second test. I mean, if they do that, then what more can the rest of the world do to put pressure on the North Koreans other than what we're doing right now?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the problems, I think it was necessary for the UN to take measures. And it's important that we be solid in implementing those measures, partly because of the signal to Iran. But, one of the problems with pressure against a regime like this North Korean regime is they tend to react to pressure through further defiance. And perhaps the more we press them, the more likely they are to test a second weapon. So it's time. Condoleezza Rice is in the region right now, talking to the Japanese, South Koreans, Chinese, and Russians. I think it's important that we all band together and come up with an appropriate mix of pressure and diplomacy so that we can walk this down before the North Koreans do something else stupid.
Mm-hmm. We have at least one more caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. David's question was certainly pertinent and to the point. However, I think he neglected to mention the power which has the most warheads after the United States and Russia, and that's Israel, who have more weapons, have more warheads than any combination of China, India, and Pakistan, and certainly threaten several of the powers in the Middle East. Iran must be very nervous about those warheads, as well as most of the Arab nations, particularly in view of Israel's very aggressive foreign policy.
Well, I was thinking primarily about about East Asia, but certainly what the caller says is correct. Can you comment on that?
Well, you're getting a little bit out of my field of specialty, but it seems to me that we all can understand why Israel, for defensive purposes, would want to have nuclear weapons. Whether that means we should condone it is another question. I think the problem that North Korea poses is quite different. North Korea has indicated a propensity to share missiles and other high-tech weaponry. North Korea is a part of a divided nation, the south of which is our ally and is in an area where it threatens many of our allies. So I think the geostrategic, totally apart from the issues of proliferation, the the geostrategic circumstances are quite different.
It seems to me that nuclear disarmament, which we were pursuing prior to the Bush administration, is really the secret here. That if we expect to see these other countries give up their nuclear weapons, which would be very desirable, and not to see the further proliferation of weapons, the United States and Russia must further reduce their stockpiles. We don't need them. We've proven that our conventional weapons are quite adequate for any purpose.
Well, I think we actually, under the Bush administration, we have been reducing our stockpiles, but I don't disagree with your basic thrust.
I'm going to jump in here because we're almost out of time. Just let me ask one further question. I think that there are some people who say that maybe, whether we like it or not, we're going to have to live with a nuclear North Korea. And that, in fact, they would go further and they would argue, you know, we lived with a nuclear Russia. And we still do, and that there are other countries that have nuclear weapons, and this principle of deterrence, the fact that we also have them, is the thing that prevented them from being used. And that if we made it very clear to the North Koreans that if you used a weapon against anybody else, if you sold a weapon to anybody else, that's it. We're all done, and we're going to respond with appropriate and significant force. What's wrong with that, of just saying, well, you know, we can live with it. We've lived with it before.
Well, I think the president essentially set forth those red lines in his statement after the North Korean test last week, indicating that there would be grave consequences for any transfer. And he also reiterated our defense alliances with Japan and South Korea, which include the nuclear umbrella. So I think it's very clear that those are red lines. I don't think we should just live with North Korean nukes. This is an erratic regime. This is an erratic regime in a busy neighborhood that threatens a lot of U.S. interests. I don't think it's too late to stop the progress of this program or even to walk it back. And I think we should bend every effort in trying to do that. It may be we have to live with it, but certainly we shouldn't live with it without trying to change things.
Well, our guest this morning, Thomas Hubbard, has 39 years in the U.S. Foreign Service. Between 2001 and 2004, he was the U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Korea. Also was one of the principal negotiators of the 1994 agreed framework aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear weapons program. He's here visiting the campus. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Programming here on WILL made possible in part by Illinois American Water. The employees of Illinois American Water are proud to serve Champaign County and are focused on being a good steward of the Mahomet Aquifer by building research, funding research to help protect and preserve this valuable water source for future generations. The program also made possible by a grant from Body Work Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Body Work has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There is more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today at 1:06 Central Time, Washington Post journalist Karen DeYoung will be our guest. We'll talk with her about the new biography that she has written, Soldier, The Life of Colin Powell. Again, Karen DeYoung will join us following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat trading at 526 and a half, down 4. In Chicago, December wheat 520 and a half, down 10 and a half. March 527, down 10 and a half. December corn 318 and a quarter, down 2 3/4. March 327 and a half, down 1 3/4. May 332 and 3/4, down 3. July 337, down 2. November soybean 603 and a half, up 3. January 617, up 2 1/2. March soybeans 626, up 2 1/4. November 656 and a half, up 1. December meal 179.80, down 70. December oil 25.